Recently, I found this out, that if there's no competition between AEW and WWE, then why is WWE thinking about moving NXT, which is the only weekly show on the network, to Fox Sports 1 in October on the same night that AEW airs their show in October, and there's no competition? This means that it would be competition between NXT, which is mostly taped in advance, and AEW, which is supposed to be live every week. Now, this would give the NXT guys and girls a outside the WWE spectrum to perform at. The only problem is, if you're going to put NXT on FS1, put something on the network to replace NXT that is not already on the network. You know, don't let don't put NXT on FS1, and then don't put anything on the network that to replace it. That would be stupid. Now, tomorrow is the Evolve show, the anniversary show on the network. It also happens to be the Fight for the Fallen show in Florida for AEW, but there's no competition. Extreme Rules is this coming Sunday. The only thing I'm interested in is The Undertaker. That is the only reason I may be going. Otherwise, if it was just Roman Reigns playing with himself, there's no way I would be going to see that when I can see that every week. Kevin Owens might be turning into Stone Cold Steve Austin and stunning Shane McMahon. Shane McMahon may be slowly taken off of television. You should concentrate more on the wrestling talent you have, not on the ass-kissing talent that you have.
I'm in this house by myself, but Sean has pulled the coup today. He had a family emergency, a business emergency. He is a nervous wreck, but he has missed a fantastic show. That this show is going to absolutely be the best of the timelines. This is number 3 of the Deep Dive Timeline of Memphis Wrestling. We are going to examine the years 1980, 81, and 82. Some of the stuff we will be talking about. And listen to this, folks. Jerry Lawler breaks his leg. Jerry Lawler returns. Jimmy Hart forms the First Family. Jerry Lawler wrestles Hulk Hogan. The empty Coliseum match with Terry Funk and Jerry Lawler. The debut of Andy Kaufman, the debut of Kamala, the debut of Jim Cornette in the wrestling business, the creation of the Fabulous Ones, Lawler, Bockwinkle series of matches, and a lot more. But first things first, I cut.
The following show is a Pod Avenue production.
You watch the Fabulous One.
Get out of my way, boy. Get out of my way, because you are in for the worst beating that you've ever taken in your life. Do you understand that, Pally?
The king.
King of them all, right here it is, baby. The greatest wrestler that ever lived and ever will step into a ring. You're looking at him, and I am the champion.
And a superstar.
If it came to singing, I'm better than you. If it came to dancing, I'm better than you. And when it comes to wrestling and fighting, I'm better than you, Mantell. That's why everybody's jealous of me. I'm the best there is, because I got the belt.
Basketball player. He wanted to win. He wanted to help his team win. And it ended up, it was a terrible situation where he got hurt. And no telling how long he's going to be out. I hadn't heard any updates today on Wednesday that were taken, but it's the same sort of thing that you just don't understand. A wrestler in Goldberg knew knew he was hurt, and he needed to be taken out of the game. But to me,
when you get down, Bo.
Yeah,
You know, and especially at his age, it's little bitty things can go very wrong very fast. And he's talking about Eddie. I'm amazed. Two people that I speak with regular, Charlie Smith, the referee for many years from Georgia, worked in the Georgia office, 89 years old, and then Eddie Marlin, 88 years old. You know, you could call and ask them about certain people doing research from the 50s and 60s, and their minds are so clear they can tell you about them and still have memories of certain people. And, you know, it's shows that, you know, Eddie, he wore out a little bit, his body, of course, with his COPD and stuff, but his spirit is still strong, his mind is still strong, and he's still got a will to keep moving forward.
I appreciate very much. You, of course, have been, how many times have you been texting me a day, 30 or 40, just say, how's Eddie, right? And so many more, thousands of people reaching out, and I appreciate it very much. So that's the update. Now we're going to deep dive into 80, 81, and 82. And Bo, as you know, I'm older than you. First started watching wrestling in 71 or 72. Jerry Jarrett split from Nick Gulas in 1977. But in 1980, everything was going great. 77, of course, with Waller Dundee, was banging with the debut. 78, we joined the AWA. 79, Hogan was here. The 2 o'clock concession stand brawl. Robert Fuller booked all kinds of things going on. And at the end of 79, as we talked about last week, Waller was switched heel again, and Jimmy Hart. Not really. Would you call Jimmy Hart at that time the first run as Jerry Lawler's manager, or do you think he, I don't know what you would call it. Basically, he was out there to distract the referee, get involved in the finish, because he wasn't out there to do Jerry Lawler's talking.
He was more of just like a cheerleader, more right. than a manager.
Well, that, obviously, would you say from, say, 73 on, Memphis territory was built around Jerry Lawler?
Of course.
And, you know, one of the things Jerry, this is funny, because Jerry got so mad at Lawler because he told him, don't play football, you get hurt. And then he ended up getting hurt, and that took place at the end of January in 1980. But to just get the people a feel of the very last card that he was on before he got hurt. It was January the 28th, 1980. It drew 5,300 people. Go ahead and read that card, and there's maybe one name in this thing, especially in one of the persons going against the Gibsons in the third match, so people might not realize who that is. But read this card and explain what's really going on.
Looking at it right off bat, only five matches in Memphis. That was kind of unusual. There was usually more matches than that. But Ricky Morton beat Jerry Bryant in the opener. Sonny King went to a draw with Paul Ellering, who would become the manager of the Road Warriors just a few years later. Rick and Robert Gibson over Sugar Bear Harris and Buddy Wayne. And I'll get back to Sugar Bear Harris there in just a second. The Assassins against Ken Lucas and Steve Regal, then Fargo and Dundee with Lawler and Jimmy Hart in the main event. And Sugar Bear Harris, for people that do not know, was also known as Ugly Bear Harris, who was later become Kamala.
Absolutely. And I didn't think very many people would know that. And honestly, I don't remember that. I don't know. Did he work the whole territory? I didn't start going to a couple of weeks after that every week, but did Sugar Bear work the whole territory or not?
Well, looking here, January of 80, he's in Knoxville in March of 80 working. He's the champion here in Knoxville as Ugly Bear Harris, so may have just been passing through. He may have just picked up Memphis on the way coming through, I'm not sure.
Now, besides Randy Colley, who were the Assassins? Was it Roger Smith, or do you know?
This set of assassins in 79 was Randy Colley and Kurt Von Hess.
You're kidding?
No.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And they wore a little different outfit than Jody Hamilton and Roger and Donnie wore. And they were introduced as being from Pittsburgh. And they wore the gold and black like the Pittsburgh Steelers.
That's real interesting. And I like that. I certainly like that tag team. And that's a hell of a card. And, you know, 5,300 people in January in the middle of winter is a hell of a house, right?
Yeah. You know, especially for Memphis, where, you know, if they get one snowflake, the whole city shuts down, or just a threat of snow.
There you are, you East Tennessee. You have a bias toward us Memphis and Nashville people. You really do. Cut Bojangles anyway. Yeah. So Lawler breaks his leg. You can imagine the panic from Jerry Jarrett, the panic from all the wrestlers. Everybody thinks they're not going to last at all. And before we get into this thing, it's an absolutely fantastic thing of what they ended up. With Bo, because I get going and I get passionate and fired up and I get pulled up. And so, Bo, you're going to have to help me out.
The fact you don't want to talk about it at the moment is very typical.
This is interesting, and I want you to dissect this card, because this show was the start of the rest of the year. This is the starting over point. The first show after the broken leg was on February. The 4th, 1980, it drew 4,900 people, and I think that's excellent, but go ahead with that card.
Yeah, Robert Gibson and Paul Ellering in the opener, both of them would go on to do a lot bigger stuff than opening matches. Steve Regal, Mr. Electricity from Indianapolis, and Ricky Morton against the Assassin and Sonny King, only one Assassin here. Bill Dundee and Sugar Bear Harris, so I guess Sugar Bear was in the territory or just working Memphis on Monday nights. Then the Assassins with Billy Robinson and Ken Lucas, and then on top, Ricky Gibson and Handsome Jimmy for the Southern title. And of course,
74, but don't, Robinson, Lucas, and Ricky Gibson.
Really not a lot of big bumps, not a lot of big high spots. Just out of high school, selling out in his home territory as a 17-year-old kid. And then shortly after that, came to Tennessee and was selling out here as an 18, 19-year-old kid. And he had that natural fire. He wasn't a well-polished interview, but he was a humble babyface interview. Thank you, Mr. Russell. Thank you, Mr. Brown, for letting me come out here and talk. And he wasn't in his interview, he wasn't talking at the people. He talked to the people. And he knew how to do it, how to be that down-home country Jack Briscoe. That was his hero. The arm drags, the facial expressions, reaching for the rope, trying to get help. All of that Steamboat took from being a kid watching Jack Briscoe. Ricky Morton took all of his stuff from first watching Ken Lucas as a kid. Then electrocutes him with the machine gun punch, and when he could stand in the middle of the
room. Want to run back. Yeah, but there's a false narrative that the company did horrible, that you can't draw at all without Jerry Lawler on the card, and obviously it just dropped a few hundred people in the next week after Lawler broke his leg. Then we skipped to April the 28th, and I'll read the card. 8,250 people for Rick and Robert Gibson against Ollie Hussein and Sonny King. Rick Morton, Terry Sawyer, and Buddy Fuller. What a team. Now, Terry Sawyer was helping Buddy run his wrestling camp, and we could talk about that and some of the guys that were in it. But they beat the Blonde Bombers and Danny Davis. Dundee, I guess a babyface match, and I don't remember this, but it was Dundee over Ken Lucas. Then Rocky Johnson back, and he got beat as he wrestled the new king, Paul Murray. And then a hell of a tag team, David Schultz and Dennis Condrey, defeated Regal and Handsome Jimmy Valiant. Then the main event was Billy Robinson over the International Superstar to win the vacant CWA title. And the notes from Memphis Wrestling History, Mid-South Coliseum, MemphisWrestlingHistory.com says the International Superstar was Bill Eady. I never remember Bill Eady being here, so no, I don't know if that's
wasn't
true.
Wasn't him.
Right.
He, Bill himself told me he never worked Tennessee. Never was here. Do you remember the two big angles going into this card? The one with Buddy Fuller and Danny Davis?
Just briefly, repeat. Smarten us up.
They did the amateur challenge where Terry Sawyer and different guys, they were doing the amateur wrestling matches on TV. And they had one with Danny Davis and Terry Sawyer, and Buddy was one of the judges, and I think it went to the time limit, so they gave the match to Sawyer on points, which caused Davis to go after Buddy. They end up in the ring, and here comes the Blonde Bombers, here comes Sawyer and those guys, and for all purpose sake, Buddy was retired at that point in time, was working in the office, and he comes out of retirement to have this six-man match with the other two young guys, and then the other big hot angle here was Schultz and Condrey in their 1970, still wearing them in the end of early 80, disco suit with their cake at ringside. When Handsome Jimmy and Steve Regal come out and feed them the cake and rubbing their face in it, and Handsome yelling, "Suey, suey," and you know, haha, it's funny. This is that plus 10. Because after they run their face in the cake, they scoop it up with their hands and are
amazing. As we continue, Life Without Jerry Lawler, May the 5th, Dick Bockwinkle defended the AWA World title. He got a disqualification win over Bill Dundee. June the 23rd, they reformed an interesting tag team as the Blonde Bombers were programmed with JoJo Yamamoto, and Jerry Jarrett, I guess, thought his main star was gone, and so he's going to get the tights back on. Then on August the 4th, 7,100 people witnessed Dundee wrestle Billy Robinson again. August the 25th was the switch by Tommy Rich. Tommy Rich came back in the territory and left Georgia. He ended up, do you remember that finish? It was a simple finish that switched him. And then in the same period of time, Jerry Lawler was appearing doing some commentary, and Rich bullied Lawler. I love this deal, this switch with Tommy Rich. Any memories of that?
Yeah. As Bobby Eaton says, the No Heat Express. they switched Tommy Rich. He, you know, came back and did the interview. He sucker punched Dundee for the finish. Just one punch, wasn't it?
I thought it was a nut shot.
Maybe that's what it was. Just right. Something real. He just something you would not expect it. Right. And then he did the interview about, "I'm the big star. I'm Atlanta TV. I should be the king of wrestling. I should be the champion. I should be," you know, it was like a hometown boy coming back, but now he's too good for the rest of us. He's became one of those people that went off and became a big star. And at the same time, Bobby Eaton had just come in and debuted, left Knoxville, came down there. Bobby Eaton, the king of wrestling, for a short time with Jimmy Hart. And, you know, it was, they're trying to figure something out. Randy, you know as well as I do, when you're booking, when you're doing TV every week, when you're doing this and that, not everything sticks. And sometimes you realize, okay, we may have made a mistake here.
Right.
But
right.
And they obviously realized that the same way that Ron Fuller realized that when they switched Wendell Cooley, we should have never did that.
Well, it happens. It's happened to me. I'm sure it's happened to you.
It's happened to me, yes. Right. Yes.
Then, and go ahead.
So they try, and like you said, they don't know how long Lawler's going to be out, so they have to figure out. We need a long-term game plan here of who is going to get that top heel spot. And Rich had all the publicity in the world with TBS, and he was on the cover of every magazine you could imagine.
And, you know, it looked good on paper. It didn't work out. And I think because it didn't draw, they rushed Lawler back with a single match with Jimmy Hart for 7,100 people. Then the next week, one of Hart's first family members, Killer Carl, crew, both of them had to wear gas. Lawler a gas, of course, because he was wearing a gas. And group two, then Lawler went away. You know, he agitated the injury, so they got two weeks out of that. During that period of time, I don't know if you knew this, but Waller started back booking a few weeks before he started wrestling. I guess Jarrett, knowing that it was close, and was trying to give him incentive to come back. I don't really know, but Waller was booking it, didn't last long at all because he aggravated his leg, and so he couldn't make the town. Then on November the 24th, around that time, and I'll let you explain this angle. Like you said, they knew it wasn't working. So the whole deal that led to Rich and Dundee reforming their tag team from 76, maybe 77, they put them back together. And the classic angle with Jimmy Valiant and Tojo and Peggy Rich.
Peggy Rich. And Eddie Marlin, who was also a big part of this angle, Eddie Marlin, who comes out and does the setup for Peggy Rich, about how he's known Peggy since Tommy was a kid. They used to come to the wrestling matches in Nashville, and she was brokenhearted over her son, and she would like for everyone just to give her a couple of minutes to let her come out and explain. And she comes out and does the interview, in tearful interview about how Tommy dreamed of being a professional wrestler. He dreamed of being a top star like the Eddie Marlins that he watched as a kid, like Tojo, like Jarrett. And he didn't have it happen for him here in Tennessee the first time, so he left and went to Atlanta, and it happened for him in Atlanta. He became a huge star, and he called and said, "Mama, I'm coming home, and I hope this time the people will love me and the people will like me and the people will do this and that for me like they have in Atlanta and like they have in Ohio." And as she's talking, out comes Handsome Jimmy, who's mad. Handsome's also, they do the double switch here. Handsome is a baby face. And he felt that he had got ripped off in the TV title tournament with Coco. Earlier, it was either earlier that day or the week before. And he broke Coco's TV and stomped off. So here comes Handsome, and he starts insulting Peggy and talking about her. And here comes Tojo, and Handsome pushes Peggy down. And as Handsome says, "I had no idea he was going to do it." But Tojo slaps Peggy Rich, and she's down on the ground. And here comes Tommy Rich, and then they just double team him, beat him to death. He brings the milk. He's covered in blood, and now they've got something hot. Tommy Rich is a baby face again. People feel sorry for him. The girls are going to cheer him. They're going to go crazy for him. He's going to sell for these two mean, nasty heels. And now they know they're back on track for something good.
And that's one of the classic of all time with Peggy Rich. And the good thing about the thing, obviously it was an angle. It was definitely an angle. But a lot of things that Eddie Marlin said on that interview and Tommy Rich said on his interview, it was the truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
No doubt.
jumped ahead 2 years. Never mind me, Randy. But we get to December the 29th. Once we get to the main event, we will backtrack on the story of Waller's opponent and what they did at the Coliseum a couple of weeks beforehand. But it did 11,100 people. I've explained. Sometimes you see a sellout at 11.7. Sometimes you see a sellout at 11.1. It depends on how it's scaled, and it depends on it. The fire marshal's there. But go ahead, Bo. Let's take a
look. You know what also else took some seats out of this night?
What was that?
The stage.
That's exactly right.
The stage is set up for Lawler's entrance.
And that had to take, what, 300, 400, 500 seats?
Yeah, because it's got that whole backside of the ringside back there.
No doubt about it. Let's go ahead, Bo. Go ahead and take a look at that. December 29th, the King is back.
Yep. Morton, Ricky Morton and Sonny King with Tojo and Gypsy Joe, the No Pain Train. And Morton and Sonny King were a remake of Jerry Jarrett and Tojo Yamamoto from a decade earlier, where this tough, rough, mean old heel feels sorry for this young baby face, and he takes him and he starts to mold him and teach him how to stand up for himself. Then you had Tommy Gilbert with the Pride of Bluntville, Tennessee, the Angel Frank Morrell. Tony Charles and Wild Bill Irwin, who was Dr. Bill Irwin at this time. He hadn't become wild yet. He was a doctor. Handsome Jimmy and Carl Fergie. And then you got Tony Charles, Ricky Morton, Carl Fergie, Sonny King, and Tommy Gilbert over Handsome Jimmy, Tojo, Irwin, Gypsy Joe, and the Angel. Loser Leave Town match. Wildfire Tommy Rich, Superstar Bill Dundee against Guy the Stomper Mitchell, and Nature Boy Roger Kirby. Guess who left town there?
Put money on it.
Yeah.
Now we're getting to the good part, folks.
Yep, now we get to the main event. Jerry the King Lawler returns to beat the Dream Machine and get a match with Jimmy Hart, who he also beats.
They could have brought in a Hogan, or they could have brought in a Idol, or a Plunk, or anybody. They went, because I think they thought they didn't need it. And it was brilliant. It was absolutely done brilliant. What's your memories of the Dream Machine getting a start there in Memphis?
I'm trying to remember. Of course, just weeks, months before this, I was watching him here in Knoxville without the mask. As Troy T. Tyler. So when I first saw Memphis Wrestling just a few weeks after what we're talking about here, and he came out and began to speak on TV, I knew exactly who it was.
That's cool. And I'll smarten you up on what happened the week before. You know, Waller's cousin is Carl Fergie. And so Dream Machine beat up Carl Fergie and kept beating, and Waller came out, Dream rode out, and they got in a little pull apart. As simple as that. Dream Machine was able to do that interview. Waller did the interview. A focus of the interview, I'm going to beat that Dream Machine. Jimmy Hart said, what do you do with the horse that breaks his leg? You shoot him. We listened to that. It seems like hours ago that we listened to that. But we did listen to that interview, and we work all the way to that, and they get 11,100. They get a sellout of that. And so would you absolutely say, because you've seen companies go out of business that or take a drastic drop, and of course, when they switched Tommy Hill, there was some weeks at 3 and they were lucky to do 4,000, but a lot of 3,000 and maybe even a 2,700. 100 crowds, some bad crowds, but for the most part, don't you think it's between Valiant and Dundee and Jimmy Hart and the First Family. It was absolutely remarkable because they changed their focus. They had Billy Robinson and Ken Lucas and Tony Charles. They even had Terry Sawyer. It was a different promotion.
Right. Yes, it was. And for the people listening, I meant to say this earlier. Terry Sawyer, and I see this confused online all the time. Terry Sawyer is not Mad Dog Buzz Sawyer. Some resemblance. Terry Sawyer is from Norfolk area of Virginia, up around where Luke Thass was out of. He was a great amateur wrestler who broke in Carolinas, and then he wrestled in Georgia, wrestled in Tennessee. I'm not sure where all else he was at, Crockett's, of course. But two totally different guys who just happened to start around the same time. And in Knoxville, Terry left and Buzz came in a matter of a week. And the same thing happened, I think, in Georgia. So people see, like, when they do the results and they're going down through there and they see Terry Sawyer, Buzz Sawyer, they think it's the same guy. Two completely different guys.
And that Terry was just—he didn't look like he could whoop anybody, and he was soft-spoken and all.
Yep.
But I loved that as a babyface, and I thought he was a hell of a worker. I think he has two out, and the third one's coming. Is that correct, Bo?
Got three out. Four and five will be here before Christmas.
All right, that's great, and it's interesting because, folks, if you want to know what it was, life on the road, and let me tell you something, there's demons out there, and it's a completely honest book, it's a truthful book, it at times is so funny and will move you, at other times it will make you cry, and it's just a great book, and you can go to kingofkingsport.com. Now, as I got the plug, then we can plug a lot more. I learned from Lance Russell, Bo, about how to so I just do it in real quick, and we'll reset, and we're jumping to another year. We're going to start in 81, and we're going to try to not, especially in the course of 81, we're going to run through this pretty quickly. January the 5th, 6,500 people. Waller defeated Ellery, then he came back, and he defeated Jimmy Hart and Jimmy Vangan. And they're going with Waller all the way heavy. January the 12th, almost 6,000 people with Idol. Go Blast from the Past. Also a Blast from the Past from 78, 79, January the 18th. Then 108 people with Joe LeDuc. And then the next week, January 26th, Cowboy Ron Bass, who was a great, great worker. Never got over here in Memphis. I'm not blaming him because he got over a lot of places.
The thing about him, he got over in Alabama. Him and Don Bass, you know, I was told by many of the guys that worked the territory, including Cowboy that booked it, that he said they were the most overheeled team that was ever here. Don Bass, Ron Bass, and Maul Bass. And it just, for some reason, but we saw it too with guys from Knoxville to Memphis. It didn't work. Memphis guys to Knoxville didn't always work. But in Alabama, Ron and Don Bass were over. They drew lots and lots of money.
Lots of money. And they were pushing him here, no doubt about it. February the 2nd, Idol and Waller again. February the 9th, the big one, because they even made a little phone call to Vince McMahon Sr. And it was Hulk Hogan. And a sad note, you probably heard me say this, and you've read the manuscript of my book, I think you probably heard this. The worst night of my life. I wanted to go see Hogan and Waller. My dad had been sick, and he had cancer, and we had taken him to the hospital the night before, and, you know, I was so excited. The only thing that kept me going, excited about the first appearance that he made in Memphis since 1979 when he started here, but certainly his first appearance since becoming a star. So that's a night. When I got home, Bo, the sad story of that, when I got home, no cell phones at that time, and my mother probably wouldn't have called me anyway, thinking I'd run off the road. But my dad had passed away on February the 9th there in 1981. So that's something when I talk about, when I see video highlights of that sort of thing, it always makes me think, match, that's still on YouTube now. Just a fantastic match. The next week it was doing...
You know what I love about that match with Funk and Lawler? Jerry Lawler drops the strap. And you think they're ready to go. And it still goes on for another 5 or 6 minutes.
Absolutely. And the finish with the chair, Funk had the chair, Lawler had the chair, and those punches from both and everything, how Funk was trying to break the leg again, ripped his tights off. It was just a fantastic...
And Lawler's all in white. His legs are covered in blood from him and Terry both.
No doubt about it. And also, during that same time period, the empty Coliseum match happened with Jerry Lawler and Terry Funk. And what people don't know, people would probably think, man, that did a lot of money. I think they just wrestled one or two times after that. That was a great idea on paper, and it was Terry Funk's idea. But here's the thing, Bo, the heel got beat up.
Yeah.
Got blinded.
And Funk does not like talking about it to this day.
Because yeah. That was his idea.
Right.
But we all, and you know, everybody, I'll snap a little bit, not snap, but here's the thing, when, you know how social media is these days and how they knock WWE, not AEW, or not quite at that. It's not science, folks. And sometimes things look good. You have people, Terry Funk and Jerry Lawler both.
The reason that people romanticize about it being this great thing, they thought they were seeing something they weren't supposed to see. And when tape trading around this time, people are starting to trade tape from different territories. John McAdams is getting Memphis tape TV trading WWF TVs to somebody in Memphis for him, and then he's trading them out to people, and people in Portland are trading, so all the territories. And this was one of the first tapes that was being traded out of Memphis, and they see Lance Russell smoking a cigarette. They had never seen that on camera. They hear Terry Funk cussing. They had never seen that. It was so different than whatever they saw in their local arenas and on their local TV shows at the time, that they stood up and took notice of, these guys in Tennessee are crazy. They will do anything. And they've tried to kill each other in front of nobody for no money.
Right.
You know, so...
And I think if they would have done a finish... Whatever, you could have done a million different thing. Dory could have come out. Whatever. If
that's what I've always... I have always said that was the perfect place for Dory to be hiding somewhere in the building. And then they both of them just get on Lawler and just beat him to death.
And leave him off for a month.
Yeah. Yeah.
No doubt about it. Moving right along. Talked about the empty Coliseum. I thought it was interesting to see that on June the 1st, and I remember this, Stan Lane came in as the U.S. Junior Champion, and, or maybe, I really think that might be wrong. I think Dundee had defeated, or they said he defeated him somewhere else. Anyway, Stan Lane, first appearance in Memphis as a heel on June the 1st against Dundee.
No, he did come in with the belt, lost it to Dundee.
Okay.
And then they showed the tape in Alabama, and Bill went to Alabama and dropped it back to Stan.
Right. And obviously,
I thought it was interesting, real interesting. Did you notice on my notes that I sent you the very next week, Steve Kern made his Memphis debut. Almost 8,000 people with Jim Dalton and everybody, as we'll get into before we sign off and say bye-bye, everybody. Before we do that, we will see some big things about Steve Kern and Stan Lane. But Steve came in and did some absolutely fantastic things. But, man, we had the first family against Waller, Dundee, the Dream Machine, Dutch Mantel. This was a hell of a year and a hell of a summer. I mean, Waller's return, and this is some of the greatest matches I've ever seen. So they did a dream match card, the concept, the first dream match that I know of, especially a whole card vote. It drew over 10,000 people on June the 29th. So will you be Lance Russell and Dave Brown here?
Yeah, here we go. Onita and Fuji. He was Sonny King and Ricky Morton in opening. Well, he's not even Ricky Morton yet. He's just Rick Morton. Chick Donovan and Steve Kern in the second match. Wayne Ferris, Don't Call Me the Blonde Bomber Ever Again, beat Roy Rogers, a.k.a. Johnny Rich. One of the greatest lines ever was spoken during the build-up to the Wayne Ferris-Roy Rogers feud, when Roy Rogers upsets him, and then Wayne Ferris comes back as a super destroyer and they tear his mask off. And if you see Carl Fergie to this day or Davy Rich, look right at him and say, Roy Rogers, you're a dead man. And they both will laugh about it. The delivery from Wayne Ferris so serious and you believed he was ready to kill him. Then we get the end of the dream matches here. Kevin Sullivan dream match Mantel with all the first family in a battle royal. Then Nightmare won Dream Match. The Dream Machine beat the Nightmare's handicap match, and Dream's mask was at stake. Dutch's Dream Match. Dutch beat Kevin Sullivan with Jimmy Hart banned from ringside. The Dream's Dream Match. Nightmare's mask at stake. Nightmare's over Dundee in the Dream Machine. And then we get to Lawler's Dream Match. Jerry Lawler over Jimmy Hart. Lawler chose handicap.
And then, of course, was in June, and we're going to just skip right to the next, or not the next card, but later on in August, and this was a sellout of 11,600 people, and I hope you have the backstory for this, because I look at this, Bo, and I look at what it drew, 11,600, and I look at this card, so I'm thinking there has to be something major going on, but then you read the card out loud, Bo, and then you tell me, remember what the hell we did to draw that money?
I think I do, but here we go. Opening match, Coco Beware and Roy Rogers over Jim Dalton and Tom Stanton. Gibson Brothers with Fuchi and Onita in the second one. Frazier, no contest with the Phantom, who was Sonny King. Dutch Mantel over Tojo Yamamoto in a judo jacket match. Lawler and Valiant over Dream Machine and Bugsy McGraw. And then on top, the Nightmares over Steve Kern and Bill Dundee by DQ. Was this off of the brawl in the Louisville Gardens?
It could very well be. It could be.
I think this is what this is coming off of.
And was that not a hell of a piece of business?
Oh, yeah. That may be one of the greatest fights that was ever caught on video from any territory, and especially Memphis. It was known for fighting and the brawls and the blood and the fighting in the stands with the people and knocking stuff over. That thing, it's only a few minutes long, but it seems like it was a day because there's so much going on in so many parts of the building, and it is so believable. It is a gang war. It was like something you would see in the streets of New York or see in Hurt Village there in Memphis. It was Jimmy Hart's family against the fan favorites. And, I mean, it just is something, a knockdown, drag-out fight.
No doubt about it. Then, Bo, we'll just tell everybody that on
August the 10th, and then 9,246 people. August the 17th, and then 7,900 people. August the 24th, Caller and Dream Machine did 8,100 people. And then on August the 31st, 9,100 people. Gilbert and Morton defeated Pucci and Anita for the tag team championship. There was 10 matches on the card. Dutch and Tojo continued their program. The Nightmares lost to the Gibsons in a loser league town match. And then Dundee and Lawler beat Dream Machine and Hart. So they had a loser league town match. They had a hell of a summer. It was absolutely fantastic. And I have one note here, because at the point where all of a sudden Coco Ware started his career about 78 or 79, and they did a little stuff with him for sure, and he was over, but he joined the First Family, and he became Sweet Brown Sugar.
And I still say to this day that Coco was Bobby Eaton's greatest partner.
Oh, I 100%.
That team, they were young, they were hungry, they were ahead of their time, they were so good, so fast, so believable, and not taking anything away from Condry, not taking anything away from Stanley, Coco Beware was Bobby Eaton's best partner. And I think Dennis Condry's best partner was Phil Hickerson. And of course, Stan Lane's best partner was Steve Kern.
And we're not taking anything away to all those great teams. But right. I 100% agree with you. 100% agree with you, Bo. There's no doubt in my mind. And I think most of those guys would say the same thing.
Yeah. Except Bobby Eaton, he'd be afraid to hurt somebody's feelings. He'd tell you he loved all of them the same.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that. Then, of course, in October the 12th, here comes Andy Kaufman and Wrestling Three Ladies. And then he comes back on November the 3rd, and he wrestles Foxy. What do you remember about Andy Kaufman?
Here's what I remember about Kaufman and about this situation. My mother was a fan of the show Taxi, which later in life I became a fan of the show Taxi. I was just a kid here. I didn't understand it. But I would see Andy Kaufman on television, and I hated his guts. I despised him because I knew the real Andy Kaufman. This guy on this Taxi show is just tricking you. The real guy's a jerk that makes fun of us, talks about us being from Tennessee, plow the fields and women peel the potatoes and all that stuff. But, you know, I remember the thing with Foxy, where Foxy almost beat him a couple of times. And if you go back and watch the tape now, if they would have had just maybe an extra minute to go or something, or could have went to the time limit, one of them two probably would have died of a heart attack in the ring.
No doubt about it.
I mean, it is something to go back and watch, because they both are completely mentally, physically.
A lot of different stuff, Bo, because brought in Hogan and Funk and Briscoe and created the Dream Machine from the get-go. Then later on they switched him with Babyface. Then you had these brawls with the First Family. There's the debut of Kurt and Lane in single matches. This is a tremendous, tremendous pivotal year. Now, of course, 80 was pivotal, but this was something.
Yeah, and it was very confusing for me, and I'm sure it was for other people watching here, because like I said, Troy T. Tyler, the big babyface on Knoxville TV, and then all of a sudden you see him on Memphis TV with the mask on as a heel. But you know it's him by his voice and his mannerisms. Jack Briscoe, a big baby face off of Charlotte TV that we got here. I grew up in such a great place that I was part of the Knoxville and Charlotte territories, Jim Crockett, Southeastern slash Continental. And we got Memphis TV here also. And then, of course, after the Knoxville War and everything, we got Blackjack and Flair, and then we got the Poffos. But I grew up in a great area that got to see three great territories. Then when cable came here, we got to see Georgia. But Memphis was a little confusing as a kid watching because, you know, Bugsy McGraw's a big baby face in Charlotte, and he's a heel on this TV. But the thing about Memphis that I've always loved and that I've always tried to recreate, because if you follow my career, whether anytime that I am a heel, wherever it's at, in my own promotion or working for other people, I have a first family, because that's the impact that Jimmy Hart and Jerry Lawler left on me as a child watching them. I've always had a first family. If you go to my network now, you'll see different sets of first family through the years. But Memphis, no matter how wild, how crazy, how unpredictable it got, everything always made sense. Everything. Even Dr. Frank, Lance Russell, could make it make sense. Even Chewbacca, even the San Diego Chicken. No matter what they did over the years, everything made sense in the end. When you first see the San Diego Chicken, what the crap is this guy doing here? He's got nothing to do with wrestling. Then you get the payoff 2 or 3 weeks later. It's Jimmy Hart. And then you're like, son of a gun, he got us again. You know, they paid attention to those little bitty details. And it was controlled chaos that created some of the greatest wrestling that has ever been and ever will be.
Absolutely, no doubt about it. Then, this is the thing that hurts my feelings, though, that it was real good. It was the very first Jerry Lawler, Andy Kaufman match, and it drew 8,100 people, because I just don't like it when the mainstream defines the whole Tennessee territory on this one feud. And I know
Yamamoto. Then the Pride of Chillicothe, Ohio, Bobby Fulton over J.R. Hart. Condren Rose, the original Midnight Express, over Roy Rogers and Dutch Mantell. Boy, I'd like to see that match right now myself. Steve Kern, Stan Lane, and Eric Embry over Luke Graham, the Angel, and the Dream Machine. Lawler over the Monk. Sweet Brown Sugar and Bobby Eaton beat Robert Gibson and Steve Kern. Then Kaufman and Lawler in the match that everybody still talks about. You know, like you said, they try to define the territories that. And here's what I believe. Why it didn't sell out with all the press, with all the stuff. I can remember watching the TV and my dad saying, they're never going to wrestle each other. They'll never let it happen because he'll kill him.
Right.
And I believe that a lot of people,
May 16th, 1984. So he didn't last long after this first match, because this first match took place April 5th, 1982. May 16th, 1984. He had passed away, no doubt about it. It's a real sad situation. He came back in several times, but obviously still, one of the most prideful things that Jerry Lawler did, and Bo, get your pen out, one of the most...
Before we get to that, Randy, personal experience, your thoughts on Andy Kaufman?
Personal experience, I thought he was a nice guy. They just don't respect the business. I never got that, Bo. I never got that at all. Oh, he loved the business. And because it's one of those sort of things, he can...
said that after he died, that his Andy's girlfriend would give the checks back to Lawler. He just kept them all in the shoebox, never cashed them. You know, that's something. And he grew up a fan. He grew up you know, the stuff that I've watched on Kaufman and stuff, I've read hard. I hate that. It's a sport, and you know, but it was a free art form for Andy Kaufman. And to jump ahead just a little bit too, you know, we was talking about him being sick and not lasting long. The interview from, I guess, Thanksgiving of 83 or 84, he does the Jerry Lawler show Thanksgiving week, and he coughs throughout the interview. And that's the week they end up finding out that he has the cancer.
I didn't know that. See, that's why I have your ass on here.
Exposed to something sometime in his lifetime, or just maybe we're all born with different parts of cancer. It seems, you know, some worse than others.
About. I don't take things like that seriously. Like, I am a star. You know, that was just a role I was playing.
Yeah.
You know?
So, in your estimation, Jerry.
And I think that he just was taking it too seriously.
You think he owes you an apology?
Look, I always said you didn't have a good sense of humor enough. Here, the people are all laughing at me.
Mm-hmm.
So it proves my point.
Yeah.
That's. Why I came here was because I asked for an apology. I apologize for all the wrestling I've ever done, all the abuse I've ever given to people that didn't understand what I was doing, and I simply think that apology is in order.
So it's come to this, hasn't it, Andy? You want Jerry to apologize. Now, is this the way, would that be an equitable thing as far as you're concerned?
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't think I owe him an apology. I think, you know, he says it was all a big joke. I'm sure it was to him. I think he came down there with the intention of...
Did you want to hurt him?
Yeah, I thought I had to.
In all the matches I ever had against 400 women, I'll tell you, I was bigger than most of them, a lot bigger, and I never, not one time did anyone ever get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I never had to prove anything. I never had to get hurt. I was always very gentle with everybody I wrestled.
You know, it's something that I take very seriously. It's the way I make my living, and he comes in making a joke out of it. He did it all for publicity. That's why he's still wearing, I don't know if it's a neck brace or a flea collar. I mean, you know, it's...
I had to spend 3 days in the hospital in traction, and I was given this neck brace in the hospital. It's a very real neck brace. It's a real thing. And it's
been 5 months ago.
Yeah.
But people been in car wrecks another, you know.
Yeah.
I just don't think that there was any, it wasn't really called for to do. I could have been killed.
Well,
I could have been, have my neck broken.
But on the other hand, I mean, nobody actually forced you into the ring, you know.
That's right. I don't come out here and try to do stand-up comedy or anything like that. You know, I'm a wrestler. You're a comedian.
You were the man that you think that you are, that you'd apologize. You're the man that you would say. Because you're always talking about him being a sportsman and how you're such a...
I never say anything about being a sportsman.
Let me...
Well, I thought you're an professional athlete. You're always talking about sportsmanship, and sportsmanship isn't just to isn't
right.
to go
in
the ring.
And
if the professional
you're a comedian,
sport,
you should stay professional
sport.
Like
you don't have to go in the ring. Yeah, well, I was going in the ring, and it's something that I was doing, and it was no reason
as
to hurt
joke,
me.
Right. It's
yeah,
not a
well,
joke.
As a joke,
me.
Yeah.
You it's
know,
not a joke.
Well, it wasn't a joke to
Did
me.
You laugh after when you were laying in the hospital? It was a joke then?
No. There wasn't any reason to purposely hurt me. You could have proven the point by just beating me. You want to prove what a big man you are.
Probably view wrestling as being a show, a display, a demonstration, and this may be as the pinnacle.
Exactly what I would like to do to everybody that thinks that.
Look, I didn't sue you.
It was a chance to show them exactly what it's really
now,
like.
If there were, would you?
Really
because
like.
Let me tell you something. My father said, my manager said, they all said that I had a right. I could have got a lawyer and I could have sued you for what you did, and I didn't. And I just, all I want is an apology. Even you asked me last time I was on your show if I was going to have a lawsuit,
right,
and I could have sued you. I could have sued you for everything you're worth.
Well,
and I didn't, because I'm not that kind of a guy.
Yeah. You know what?
What kind of a guy are you?
We're going to pause here for station identification and get the hose on. he loved it. I think he was scared as it was going on, but I think that when once he got out of the studio, you know, because it was a, for all the kids listening, it went viral at that time. It was in all the papers. It was on the national news. It was everywhere in what had happened with Kaufman and Lawler. And so it kind of dies down a few months later. Here they go. They do the deal on the David Letterman show. Kaufman cussing and going on, throwing the coffee. Dave's just sitting there like, what in the world is going on? Lawler's sitting there wondering if he's going to jail for slapping him because they're going to call the cops, you know. And they get out of there, and I think Letterman and his people were the same. And here's the reason why. And you know this, being a booker, you know this, Randy. If it's bad, it don't make TV.
Right.
If it ain't going to drop, said all them cuss words, I don't know how Letterman survived that. Well, it made him, because there he is. David Letterman, who was a late-night show, came on at 12:30 a.m. during the week, Eastern time, 11:30 Central time, so late at night. Most people's already in bed. They've already seen Johnny Carson. They've had enough of the day. People started watching David Letterman because of the press that that slap got. And look at the career that that man ended up having.
Oh, it was absolutely tremendous. And we would revisit, not for very many years, as we said. Well, Andy passed away in 84, but they would come back to this and did some pretty cool stuff. And when we end up going ahead and doing next week, we'll do 83, 84, and 85, so we'll talk about Andy again. So it was time to create your summer business, and this was into May, and toward the end of May, and they ended up, you mentioned the cards earlier were Sugar Bear Harris, and everybody knows that story, so we're not going to give a lot of detail. I'm just saying Sugar Bear Harris ended up Kamala, and this was Jerry Jarrett and Jerry Waller looking around and the National Geographic and getting the idea, coming up with Kamala's name and deal.
Let me question that for a minute. Because that's the story that we've been told. That's the story that we know. But from where we saw him earlier, a year earlier, as Sugar Bear Harris, until he becomes Kamala, he had a huge run in England as the Mississippi Mauler with the Kamala face paint. Could it have been when he came to Memphis that Monday night looking for work? Yes, they already had the idea, but he had the look.
Well, it certainly could have been, and obviously, you know, wrestling promotion, like Christian or somebody that lives there, Jerry Jarrett is not there. But the farm was there, and the farm's not there now. There's 1,000 houses. But anyway, they did this video, and Michael St. John did the audio to introduce Kamala. It's simple, but it's great. Let's listen to that, Bo.
Henry turned 8 years old.
What do you remember about Kamala?
Terrified. Nightmares. Scared. There's four real, true heels of my childhood who put the fear of God into me. The Mongolian Stomper, because I saw him live so many times and just was terrified of him. Then I grew up, got in the wrestling business, got to become friends of him, and I was really afraid of him then. The Great Kabuki, with the mist and the face paint and all the ninja stuff and the devil face and all that stuff. And then Abdullah the Butcher and Kamala. Those were guys that it was such a simple change from Sugar Bear Harris, shave his head, put face paint on him, and put a moon on his belly and a star.